Hello. Fan pregame back on a Monday afternoon, the last week of the regular season in the NHL. Lots of teams with meaningful games, with playoff clinching scenarios or seeding implications. On tonight's network, we're going to go through all of that and more with Jeff on our Merrick Monday.
From the Rockies to the league best Yankees, Blue Jays opening three-game set with the Bronx Bombers tonight at Rogers Center. Caitlin McGrath will be on in about a half hour to discuss all things Jays.
We're going to discuss our own Hart Trophy rankings, subject to change with some milestones pending. We're going to put our best bets in as well later in the show. I know the Hart Trophy debate is something that we're all participating in, as it is probably the best it's been in a very long time. So we'll try to give our own thoughts on who deserves the trophy.
There might be too many people participating in that. It was a great weekend. And what happens after a great weekend? Well, we open the text line. 590-590. What was the best sporting moment you saw over the weekend? Plenty to choose from. We'll debate at the end of the show.
Okay, and you mentioned it. Jays back in action tonight against the Yankees. That's at Sportsnet on 7 o'clock, of course, and here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. And a three-game homestand, there's like a lot of positive news just on the horizon here. Danny Jansen is back. Will be back, I guess, activated from the Blue Jays. Romano and Swanson are soon, possibly even as soon as tomorrow, to be back in the lineup. And then Turner and IKF have been a discussion we were just having off air about, well, maybe this isn't that bad of an off season. If you look at what Turner and IKF have done, they have kind of been the most, I guess, reliable and consistent Blue Jays to start this season, just how everybody had written it down. So maybe they deserve a little bit more credit, the players themselves.
The players themselves, maybe management as well. I mean, Justin Turner is looking like the exact addition that the Toronto Blue Jays needed. We're missing last year, have been missing over the last couple of years. He's been everything and more, run producing. Every time he's up, he seems like someone's on base and he's sending them around third base. He's been so, so good. He's been one of the best players in baseball to this point. And IKF, I mean, I think he's exceeded everyone's expectations. Was he the perfect addition? Was he exactly what they needed? I'm not really sure, but he's been really good so far. And the best players, arguably, for this team, at least from a position standpoint, to this point have been the newcomers, so it's hard to really quibble with that. I guess the problem is that they separated themselves from, well, the core that's been here and the core that continues to maybe not live up to the billing. So there's plenty of time, obviously, but Justin Turner's been pretty indispensable so far for the Blue Jays, who got 2 of 3 over the weekend against Colorado.
Yeah, Justin Turner leading MLB in batting average, .386, getting on base 48.1% of the time, which is second best in MLB, and leading the team in WAR. What I thought was interesting is 5-for-9 with runners in scoring position. What was an issue that the Blue Jays had last year? Runners in scoring position. Mm-hmm. He's 5-for-9, 2 doubles, and 7 RBI in that span. And the thing that I was most encouraged by when they had the addition of Justin Turner was he has that, I always use Kevin Barker's phrasing of it, is like the professional at-bats. And not that the Blue Jays are young anymore, and Bo Bichette said that himself this offseason, but you know, he has so much experience and an expertise and a knowledge of the moment. And you've seen that already in his short tenure as a Blue Jay. He just knows when to be a performer. And we've seen that. He's been very consistent. And that's what a veteran voice does. A veteran voice like a Marcus Semien, like somebody that the Blue Jays have added in the past. Justin Turner is doing that and leading MLB in batting average. And then IKF is behind only Turner and Springer in hits. Tied with Biggio, and Biggio deserves a little bit of credit because I was doing some cross analysis. Okay, who's being the most productive on the Blue Jays right now? And it was Turner, IKF, and Biggio mostly in the top three, which, again, as we all predicted, not. Tied with Biggio at 13 for hits, and then he's third on the team behind Turner and Biggio in average as well. So maybe not like the most sexy, glamorous offseason in terms of the Blue Jays. And yes, it's early, and this could all be like Matt Chapman of April last year.
That's a good point.
I do remember the Matt Chapman April, May, where he was the best MLB player in the entire league. And then what happened? But in the moment, there's things to be encouraged by, and it is those two and their production early on as Blue Jays.
I'm encouraged by IKF. This might, you know, old takes exposed. It could be that. But the swing looks beautiful. And again, I get in cross analysis every at bat, and like maybe I'm just cherry picking the good results. But the couple of really well-hit balls that he's sent in the yard, especially at Rogers Center, I mean, the swing looks beautiful. So maybe there was a tweak, an adjustment. Mm-hmm. Maybe he can be more than just a replacement-level hitter for this team and someone relied on exclusively just to play good in the field. If IKF can be someone, you know, we're always waiting on the other guys to sort of get to their peak powers as well. But this has been a pleasant little surprise so far in the Blue Jays season. As you mentioned, reinforcements on the way. Perhaps the Blue Jays are rounding into form after a difficult start, but one that they've survived to this point.
All right, Blue Jays on a little bit after us here. 7 o'clock, first pitch, Yankees. Sportsnet 590 fan and Sportsnet 1 will have that on. Sportsnet will be Montreal and Detroit, which is a massive game for the Red Wings. We'll bring in Jeff Merrick on Merrick Mondays. Jeff, thanks for jumping on. How's it going?
Yeah, no problem. How's everyone over there?
Well, how are you enjoying the studio? We saw some beautiful footage of you enjoying
pretty fancy.
The digs. You
look pretty fancy.
You look like the real deal.
They let me inside. They let me out of my house. They let me drive down the 404. They let me go into the studio. I feel like I've arrived. I'm back home now. No, it's I'm going to be doing a lot more in studio now. We're having like a little bit of an audio delay doing it from home. So I'm going to be doing more from the studio, which is fun. It's a nice studio. It's cool to be in there. That was my maiden voyage today.
It looked great. Looking forward to the Jeff Merrick show, of course. All throughout playoffs, it'll be even better, we surmise, from the studio. Red Wings and Canadiens tonight, obviously a big one, bigger for Detroit than it is Montreal, of course.
Huge,
but there are some subplots for Montreal as well. But I want to just start with the Red Wings. Like, how badly does this franchise, who's gearing up, like talking a lot about, hey, this the Little Caesars Arena, going to be off the charts tonight. It's going to be great. They're trying to hype this event up. But I guess, like, they don't have fate completely in their hands. But the Red Wings need to win these last two against Montreal, need to get into playoffs, at least for me. Like, how dire is it that they get through here?
I don't know that anyone's – it's a great question because, you know, they spent a lot of time this year in a playoff position, certainly down the stretch, and then they had the collapse. And maybe, once again, Alex Lyon can sneak a team into the playoffs here and maybe do some damage. Last year, the Panthers. This year, the Red Wings. Like, I don't think that anyone's job is in jeopardy, put it that way. Like I said, I don't think that, you know, Steve Yzerman is going to be, you know, not returning phone calls. He's going to put his phone away or maybe go on vacation. Like, I don't think anyone's job is on the line here. I know that there's been some conversation about Derek Lalonde and maybe if they, you know, if they bow out, if they don't make it into the postseason here, maybe is his job in jeopardy. I have a hard time with that one. I would really be shocked. So I don't know that we're at the place where if they don't make it, there's going to be people that vanish. There's going to be people that disappear. Like it's a Agatha Christie novel. Every time the lights flicker, a different character disappears. I don't think it's going to be like that, but it'll certainly be a disappointment considering, like, look, you look at the teams around the Detroit Red Wings, the two specifically, the Washington Capitals and the Philadelphia Flyers. Like, I'm doing double takes here, aren't you, Justin? Like, the Washington Capitals are -40 in goal differential. You don't make the playoffs with a -40 goal differential. The Philadelphia Flyers, who, as we all know, have had an epic, epic collapse here, are a -25. At least the Red Wings are a positive and a +2 on the season so far this year. And they have two, respectfully to the Montreal Canadiens, easier games than the other teams have. And Philadelphia's only got one game remaining here. So I don't know. It should be Detroit to lose as far as I'm concerned. But I'm not, like, if they bow out, I don't know that anyone's job is in jeopardy, whether it's coach or whether it's general manager. Also, you have to consider a lot of the players that Yzerman's drafted here aren't even on the team. So this isn't even anywhere close to the finished product of, you know, the Steve Yzerman Iser plan, let's just say. So I don't think jobs are in jeopardy. It would kind of just be a real drag for Detroit Red Wings fans, and I think a drag for hockey fans, because I think it's been too long since we, you know, remembered, you know, what it was like to see playoffs in Detroit. Mm-hmm. That's a great crowd.
Yeah,
a lot of people go over from Windsor as well, so it's a nice mix of Canadians and Americans as well. It's always better when a team like the Detroit Red Wings are in the playoffs.
It'd be the 9th straight year, I believe, if the Red Wings don't make it, which is crazy because, of course, they had that remarkable run, 25 quarter centuries worth of playoff appearances, and then to not get back in almost a decade would be pretty difficult to imagine.
They've had their run, to your point. They've had their Stanley Cups. Nobody is crying for Detroit. And, you know, it's just like no one should cry for the Chicago Blackhawks given their Stanley Cups, and now they're going through a rebuild. Don't cry for the Hawks and don't cry for the Wings. Those fans have been spoiled, Justin. They've been spoiled.
They have. Not so much in the last 10 years, though. Last note from this game. You mentioned, you know, it's not the most difficult schedule for Detroit down the stretch, Montreal. But they will have Lane Hutson, the Montreal Canadiens, at least for tonight. This is an exciting prospect. Maybe not the guy that's, you know, finally would push Montreal over the top, but certainly an area of a need for Montreal. What do you expect from Lane Hutson, I guess, in the short term, but more specifically in the long term for the Montreal Canadiens?
He's not a crusher. He's not a bruiser. He's not Arbor Jack Eye. He's not that type of defenseman. This is a defenseman that's on the smaller side of things. He's 5'10", 165 pounds, but he's an offensive dynamo. And he's a great skater, and he can move the puck. He's your new school defenseman. And the one thing about the Montreal Canadiens that they've tried to do here, whether it's, you know, Jonathan Kovacevich or, you know, Justin Barron or Michael Matheson, like, Ken Hughes has tried to get, like, bigger guys on the back end. You know, Lane Hutson, in some ways, and I think they're pairing him with David Savard tonight, who's 6'2", 6', maybe 6'3" as well. Like, Lane Hutson will stand out because you'll look at him and you'll kind of say, where's the rest of you? Like, he is on the smaller side of things. But he's someone that, listen, I mean, he's had a tremendous college career, as we all know. He's someone that Montreal Canadiens fans should be excited about. Like, we've always mentioned, like, you can have, like, one, maybe two smaller defensemen on your team. You can't have six or five. But the first thing that's going to jump out at you about Hutson is just how well he skates and how well he moves the puck. And, you know, it's only going to be a couple of games. Maybe he doesn't even play in the second game. But, I mean, you'll notice just the elite vision and the elite skill that this guy has. Just don't expect him to leave any bruises out there tonight.
We're talking to Jeff Merrick of the Jeff Merrick Show and 32 Thoughts, the podcast. It's been a bit of a busy week in terms of news around Utah, Salt Lake City, and Arizona Coyotes. I guess, like, Sparks notes. I don't know if you had that when you were in high school, but I definitely did. If you've kind of been trying to catch up and get up to date with what's going on or what's pending with Utah, it's kind of hard to get that all distilled into one concrete answer. So for you, Jeff, like, where are we at with this Utah sale, or not even sale, I guess, relocation, and the idea that maybe, you know, you're hearing rumors that they would want to come back to Arizona one day? It's been kind of really messy. I wonder what you know at this point is to be true.
First of all, we just had a generation gap happen between us. Ailish, when I went to high school, they were called Cole's Notes.
Okay,
and now you
same
have
kind of thing.
And mine were Cole's Notes, too. I can't believe there's a gap here, but there is.
First Notes, Cole's Notes, same thing.
Okay, so first of all, the one thing that everybody should know is everybody here wants to get this done this week. The one thing about the NHL is they do not want anything distracting from the Stanley Cup playoffs. They've always been consistent about that. They don't like it when business is done, you know, firings, et cetera, any type of business. They don't like that being done while the Stanley Cup playoffs are on. I don't think this is any different. And when you consider the gravity of the story, you can understand why they want this done sooner than later. And I honestly, Ailish, I think it's at the point now where even if it's not capital D done, but it's close enough to be done that everybody is protected legally, I think that they'll still announce this week that that Salt Lake City will be getting essentially the Arizona Coyotes. Although, in an interesting twist in all of this, well, first of all, the money is staggering. $1 billion goes to Alex Morello. The relocation fee will be $1.2 billion. That $200 million will get spread out amongst the other NHL teams. You know, one of the interesting things here is, the Arizona Coyotes will still exist as an entity in Arizona. It'll just be a dormant team. So it's not as if, you know, Ryan Smith, the new owner in Salt Lake City, is buying all the IP here and all the trademarks. Essentially, you know, you can make the argument he's just buying some contracts and getting a new team, because Alex Morello will be given a window, we all believe, of 5 years with a lot of benchmarks along the way to try to get Arizona to a place where they can expand back into Arizona. And essentially, Alex Morello will be given a 5-year window to have right of first refusal, or to demonstrate to the NHL that he can, you know, put together a rink and the proper business infrastructure around it to welcome hockey back to Arizona, which all of your viewers should understand is what the NHL wants. They are not abandoning this market. They still value the market, and they still want to go back to the market. So that's where we're at right now. And it does feel very much like they do want an announcement at some point this week about the Coyotes, for lack of a better term, moving to Salt Lake City, essentially Ryan Smith launching a new team in Utah.
So there's a couple things that bother me about this story. I guess the safety net, which Morello has fallen into, is probably the biggest one. I mean, there's got to be some consequences, you'd think, in this type of business, but apparently not. But the main thing, Jeff, though, is the expansion to 33. I have 33 thoughts will be great, but 33 teams in the NHL to ruin the symmetry you just achieved because you like the market that's never worked? Like, can you explain that to me?
I don't think they're going to stop at 33. I think they have designs on 34. Now, some have talked about going as high as 36. The one thing you have to keep in mind here is still there are fewer teams in America in the NHL than there are in Major League Baseball or the NFL, NBA, et cetera. So they still think there's more room to grow here in the United States. To the other part, and I want to address your first point because it's a very good one. And a lot of people have made this point. And I'll tell you what, I'll go you one step further, Justin. There's a lot of members of the Board of Governors that aren't exactly thrilled at how this has gone down. That's like, I think of teams like the Toronto Maple Leafs or the New York Rangers, you know, teams that have written you know, large revenue sharing checks for a number of years are watching Alex Morello walk away from this car wreck with $1 billion in his pocket and the right of first refusal to bring a team back. Now, the reason for that is the NHL is trying to go out of their way to make sure none of this ends up in court. Like, they are overpaying Morello. I mean, when you look at, you know, market valuation of what the Arizona Coyotes are essentially worth, it's probably somewhere in the $600 million range. I know that Ottawa, you know, they just sold for $950 million and the NHL never wants to go backwards on a sale. But when you look at fair market value, and by way of the Constitution, that's all they have to offer if essentially they're revoking a franchise, you can look at this and say, hold on a second, this guy's walking away with 1B? That's insane. But again, the one thing that all of us have to keep in mind here when it comes to this transaction, it is completely unlike any other NHL transaction we've seen because the NHL does not want to end up in court. They do not want a lawyer up here because essentially what they're saying is we're trying to get Alex Morello out and bring Ryan Smith in, and we want this to be like an Olympic diver into the water without a ripple. We want this to go in really, really smooth. So does it feel weird? Does it look wrong? Yeah, and you're not in the minority, and there are a lot of people on the Board of Governors that feel the exact same way that you do, Justin. And I'm sure behind this, like, how do you think the Rangers feel? How do you think the Maple Leafs feel after writing large revenue sharing checks for years and years and years and support, and this guy's going to walk away with $1 billion and then still maybe have the opportunity to bring another team back? Holy smokes. But all of this is done so no one ends up in court.
Merrick, before we let you go, I was just going to say, everyone should go check out Aaron Ambrose on your podcast earlier. Of course, last night's Canada-USA gold medal game. Maybe the best Canada-USA gold medal game that I remember watching, and it was unbelievable. So, I don't know if she had slept before you guys talked or she was still partying from the night before, but they deserved it.
She wasn't driving. She was with Anne-Marie, Anne-Brené Desbiens. Who wasn't driving either. I don't know whether one or both may have been over-served last night. I'm not
sure. I saw some videos. They had fun.
Okay, they had fun. Well, apparently, I asked her, who put on the lampshade? She said, I'm not going to say who, but the initials are J-L-R.
Oh, yeah.
Jamie Lee Radford,
pretty
baby.
Good one.
But listen, you know what? I think that's a direct, because I agree with you. I think that was the best gold medal game that we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And it was dynamic. And it's funny, I was just having a text exchange before I hopped on with you guys with Cassie Campbell-Pascal. And the one thing that we were talking about is, I wonder how much of that is a direct reflection of the presence of the PWHL, mm-hmm. where now athletes can be athletes, period. And it's not just a side job or not just a side hustle. now, and what you're going to see now is this effect compounding year in and year out. And now there's going to be an influx of more Europeans next year. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, three top Finns are coming into the PWHL, we suspect, next season as well. I mean, the quality is just going to go up in that league, and that means that international hockey is going to get that much better. I'm really glad you brought that up, Ailish, because it's a great point. That was maybe the best final that we've seen either at the Olympics or the World Championships, and I point a lot of that at the PWHL. Now there's a dedicated league, and the athletes can live like proper athletes. The quality of women's hockey starts to go through the roof. I think it's a great point by you.
Yeah, and I would totally echo what Cassie said, and you guys just like making that connection, because even just talking to the girls in the league, like they're not worried about having to, you know, rush home and get on the ice and help coach or help, you know, go to be a firefighter or XYZ.
Yeah.
Like they are fully focused on this, and that was the best level of play from all the other international teams as well. So I think that's just like early returns for half a PWHL season. It's certainly like elevated the play. And a lot of those young girls coming out of university, I mean, obviously, like the game winner scored by one of the probably top two or three picks for next year's draft is just a great sign for things to come. Jeff, we'll let you go then.
Danielle Serdakny.
Yep.
Like,
remember
that
the
is the name. And the other one, you know who really popped for me this tournament? Carolyn Harvey.
Oh, yeah. Oof.
Holy smokes, can she play? Absolutely. I mean, Layla Edwards is a wonderful story at Wisconsin, too. 6'2", holy smokes. But Carolyn Harvey, for me, that was an eye-opener, Ailish.
Yeah, she's 21 years old.
I know. Good Lord. I know. It's just getting better and better. I know.
Well, Jeff, I appreciate you jumping on. Happy last week of the regular season, and we'll see you around the office.
All right. You be good, you too.
Thanks, Jeff. Jeff Merrick Show and 32 Thoughts, the podcast. Quickly, do you want to do our Hart Trophy discussion?
Yeah, we'll save the best bets for the end of the show.
Okay, cool. We're talking about the biggest debate in sports right now, other than if Auston Matthews should be sitting or going to score 70 goals. So in honor of that, we have created a little bit of a false scenario at this moment, but a disclaimer is that in our Hart Trophy rankings, Auston Matthews has scored 70 goals, and McDavid and Kucherov have both recorded 100 assists. So that's an important disclaimer.
Yeah, because then we could just couch everything, right? So let's just assume.
It's not the what if. It's
that,
just happened.
That
okay?
The carrots that dangle in front of these players have been snatched up.
Ours are pretty similar. And I think that's kind of the beauty of this, because you could actually put probably five different names on a ballot. So do you want to start with the person we both have at number one?
Yeah, I picked Nathan MacKinnon number one. I do think the Colorado Avalanche stumbling to the finish line a little bit has left the door open. But I think Nathan MacKinnon achieves the balance here that others are without. He's got the most even strength points, 91 in the salary cap era. So it's not like he doesn't have the big landmark item. He does have that with 91 points, third most points in the salary cap era. And I just think Nathan MacKinnon, the goal scoring matters. He's got goals. The point total matters. He's got the points. He's got everything. And for that reason, I think it's Nathan MacKinnon.
Yep, I have Nathan MacKinnon as well. I do think the fact that he's number one helps him as well. Just adding to your points, he's factored in to a hell of a lot of Colorado success. And I think 5-on-5 is one of the key indicators to why he's at the top of my list compared to others. So I have Auston Matthews as second, and so do you. That might be hard for some people to believe if he scores 70 goals. But I will say this, the only thing that's different is he's got a little bit less points. And a lot of those points, though, are secondary points. He's still being productive if he's got 70 goals. Of course, he's got the most ever that I can even remember somebody scoring. 70 goals is going to be a really big factor for Matthews being number two on my ballot. But he falls shortest in terms of just those secondary points. And that's why when Nathan MacKinnon and maybe Kucherov or McDavid get more love, it's because he just hasn't factored in as much as others.
69 goals, 70 goals, I think both are more impressive than 100 assists. The debate that it's like, 100 assists or 70 goals, what's more impressive? It's 70 goals. I don't think it's even close. Auston Matthews, for that reason, number two to me. And I go Nikita Kucherov over McDavid just because he scored 12 more goals. If I'm going to value them with Matthews, I have to with Kucherov. I think his team probably had to survive more along the way as well to put themselves in the playoffs. So I go Kucherov three over McDavid.
I give McDavid the edge, just a slow start narrative. We still call him the best player in the world. He helped get his team from the bottom to now playoffs, kicked it into high gear. And Kucherov gets a little bit of a minus for me because he is the worst out of all those defensively, and a lot of his points have come on the power play more than everybody else's. A percentage of his points are not at even strength, so I'm just valuing a little bit of more even strength production and defensive production as well. We'll take a quick break because we're going to go through tonight's game. We got the Yankees in town and the Blue Jays. Catch us on Sportsnet 360, and if you want to watch Hockey Central, it's up on Sportsnet.
The most opinionated Maple Leaf show out there. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back on the Fan pregame on Sportsnet 360 and Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Blue Jays taking on the Yankees. 7 o'clock here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 1. If you're looking for Montreal and Detroit, that'll be up on Sportsnet at 7 o'clock. Kayla McGrath joins us from the new Rogers Center 2.0. I actually haven't asked anyone on the beat what you've noticed the most different with the second level of renovations here. Caitlin, how's it going? Thanks for jumping on.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
Has it been that different for you? Like, I went as a fan the other day and I walked around the infield area and I saw the seats, like, they looked pretty sweet, but I didn't have the ticket money to go and sit in any of them. But obviously last year's renovation versus this year, it might feel a bit more subtle. Have you heard any reviews from players or anyone in terms of the upgrades the second time around?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of what fans are experiencing, I would say that last year's renovations did feel a lot more extreme, and really noticed the difference in the 500 sections in particular, and obviously the new bullpens and all these different porches you could stand on. This year it was more just about sort of reconfiguring the lower bowl, and so people that are sitting down there are probably experiencing a slight difference in terms of the seats are spacing home plate more, and that was kind of the intention of it. And then obviously the newer seats behind home plate, the newer areas, more exclusive areas, and all this kind of stuff. So that's if you're there, you're probably noticing a lot. But I think in terms of, like, fans' experience in Rogers Center, it probably feels fairly similar to last year. I would say that I guess the extreme end of the renovations have happened behind the scenes in terms of what the players have gotten. They've gotten a brand-new clubhouse that looks a lot different. So for me, like, that's been the main difference, has been walking into the Blue Jays clubhouse. It's like I'm walking into a brand new space that I'm not used to whatsoever. different ways to navigate the stadium for us as well. And so for me, it felt different, but it's more so from the behind-the-scenes aspect as opposed to what fans are seeing.
All right, so a new face and not part of the renovations, but maybe renovating this offense, has been Justin Turner. Justin and I were talking about his addition earlier in the show, and maybe he's gone a little bit underrated in terms of the offseason acquisitions. He wasn't the sexiest name available. I think people had higher hopes, but he has come in and been absolutely incredible, I think, for the Blue Jays in terms of expectation. He's leading the MLB in batting average as well. He's getting on base all the time. He's hitting well with runners in scoring position. So what has Justin Turner done for this Blue Jays team in his short stint as a Blue Jay?
Yeah, it's exactly like you say. He's getting hits. He's pushing guys along on the bases. He's getting clutch hits when they matter. That's something that he's done his entire career. When you look back at all those years with the Dodgers, great teams with the Dodgers, always playoff teams with the Dodgers, and he's been a guy that's always been able to come through in that moment. You know, he doesn't complicate things. He kind of keeps the same approach, doesn't try to do too much. All those sort of classic cliche things that you hear players say, but he does them. And you know, I think his on-field presence has been really great for the team. He's kind of that bat that they really needed in that space in the lineup, too, where he's really patient. He always puts up a really good at-bat. He kind of knows what pitches he's looking for. The thing that also he's done maybe more behind the scenes or things that you don't necessarily see on the field is that he's been a really great resource for some of his teammates. You know, I think the other day, John Schneider likened him to almost having an extra hitting coach, even though Blue Jays have like 10.
They got a lot of those.
Yeah, they got a lot of those. But he's another one that can kind of help guys along. Sometimes players take in information differently when it comes from a teammate. So I think it is kind of helpful when you have a guy that's comfortable talking about hitting. Justin Turner has been in the league a really long time, and he's seen a lot of pitchers. He's faced a lot of guys. He has a lot of experience in that way. And so he's been good kind of just tipping guys off and saying, you know, look for this against this guy. This guy likes to throw this. This guy likes to do this, all that kind of stuff. And he has kind of the confidence to go around the room and speak up in meetings and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's also been a big influence. Maybe it's a little more subtle. Maybe you don't see it. But I think behind the scenes, Justin Turner has been a fairly big influence.
Must wear khakis in the off season. There's a bit of a ho-hum in your answer. Like, this is what he's always done, right? This is what Justin Turner does. And that is definitely true. I guess maybe the surprising thing, at least for me, is that like he continues to do it. But when you've been watching him, you're watching him closer than we have. Is there anything that does surprise you about his start, what he's done, and how he's fit with the Blue Jays?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's pretty cool that he's just seamlessly transitioned. I mean, on the one hand, he did get a taste of the AL East a little bit last year with obviously playing with Boston. So he's pretty familiar with like the division. He's played in the Rogers Center decent enough based on last year and just so over the years. But sometimes you never know when guys join a new team. I mean, we kind of saw that last year with a different guy, Dalton Varsho, where he kind of spoke openly about the fact that it was tough to come to a new team. It's tough to come and have expectations on you. You're getting used to facing different guys, hitting in a different spot, hitting with different guys around you. And so I think it's easy to sort of underestimate how difficult it can be to join a new team and try to transition. So in that way, it makes Justin Turner's start look even more impressive because it looks like he really hasn't missed a beat. He kind of looks like he's been here all along. And I think that's probably just due to his comfort as a player, as himself. He kind of knows what he needs to do. But still, it's not easy, I think. And so it's a credit to him that he's made that seamless transition.
Is that what we're seeing now with Dalton Varsho in terms of the step and maybe in the right direction? You mentioned him as a reference in terms of coming to a new team. Well, this weekend was a big one, from a grand slam to into that Rockies bullpen. Maybe a slow build, but is this the Dalton Varsho we could be hoping to see more of as the season continues?
Yeah, I think it's like, we were talking to Schneider the other day and Dalton himself, and it was like, you know, he had a really good spring training, looked really good, really confident in his approach, kind of looked like he knew exactly what he was doing, trying to get it done out there. And it went really well. And obviously, you know, the season is still so young. We're only realistically a handful of games into what is a really long season. And so you kind of look at Dalton Varsho's start and you're like, a bit of a slow start. But I don't think anyone really thought of it that way. He was still kind of going up there, doing the same thing that he was doing in spring, trying to accomplish the same thing, still feeling really confident about his approach, knowing that it's going to pay off, knowing that the work he put in is going to pay off. And so you finally saw the results coming a little bit this past weekend. Overall, he's had a lot of success against the Rockies in general, too. I think dating back to obviously his years with the Diamondbacks and playing them a bunch of times. But maybe there's something about seeing the Rockies in front of him that reinvigorated him this season or something, but it got him going a little bit. I think that he's definitely a guy to watch this year in terms of he seems a lot more comfortable, seems like he's not putting as much pressure on himself as he was maybe last year. Last year probably was a huge learning experience for him, and he's still fairly young in the league. I think we sort of forget about that sometimes, and so he's definitely someone that I think could be a really important bat for them this year.
Speaking of sweet swings over the weekend, IKF had a couple really, really nice plate appearances and big hits over the weekend. It feels like one of the contracts we're going to be debating for some time, unless he just doesn't allow for Blue Jays fans to debate it. And maybe he was taking steps in that direction over the weekend. I think redundancy was the big problem when it was signed. Has he shaken some of the redundancies for you to start the year?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, because I guess I would put it like this. I haven't really noticed too much a time where you're like, this guy hasn't been in the lineup in a while, or why is this guy hitting here? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like manager Schneider has done a fairly good job so far of getting guys into the lineup, getting guys into spots where they can succeed. I think IKF is a really capable third baseman. I think he makes his team better defensively. Like you said, he can put the bat on the ball. Not necessarily a huge home run guy, even though he had a home run the other night, but someone that can, push guys along, help when guys are on base. And I think that, he's done that. And I understand. I think you talk about the debate this offseason and, maybe it's a contract you'll look back on and sort of wonder if it was necessary. But I also think some of that was probably just brought on by a generally low feeling off season. I mean, I think you said it earlier where it's just people expected a little bit more and then you come away and you're just getting kind of complimentary guys. And so maybe that's going to like dog IKF, which is probably not fair, but it is what it is. But in terms of like his play, I mean, I, I think that he's been in there when it's necessary. And I, you know, I haven't really looked at the lineup one day and thought, this guy hasn't been in the spots. Like, I think that Schneider has done a good job of balancing guys and making sure they're in there when they need to be.
We're talking to Caitlin McGrath ahead of Blue Jays and Yankees. So some good news today in terms of injury return. For sure, Danny Jansen will be back, and then maybe a couple days or even a day or two before we see Romano and Swanson. But I wonder for you, so Jansen returning, of course, is important offensively and in terms of catching, but Kirk really handled a lot over the stretch at this beginning of the season. So Danny coming back, like how this affects the inner workings of the Blue Jays lineup, and specifically with Kirk maybe getting a little bit more rest.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you have Kirk in there today because mm-hmm. he's typically been the guy that's been catching Bassett quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And so probably you see Jansen tomorrow, and then maybe you see Kirk again Wednesday just because of the night game, I should say. But I think beyond that, then you're going to see more of a regular balance with them. You're not going to have to worry too much about, easing Danny in. And you're probably looking a little bit ahead and trying to find spots to get Kirk some rest because, as you say, he has been playing a ton. And it's hard. I think that Kirk handled that well last year in terms of, I think last year he caught a career-high games behind the plate. And, you know, right off the bat this year, you're again having, you know, most of the load on you because of Jansen's injury. So I think it would be a good time once Jansen sort of clears that little threshold of the first few games and he's feeling good and everything's, you know, good to go. I think it'd be good to get him in there probably a little bit more so than Kirk, just to give Kirk a bit of a breather. You have to give him credit. I know that maybe the bat hasn't been quite what people want it to be, but again, it's very early in the season, and I think that it's a challenge. It's a challenge catching as much as Kirk does, and so hopefully not only will Danny just help the lineup in general, because obviously he's a great bat, he's hit for a lot of his power over the last few years, but also just having him back will take the load off Kirk a little bit, and sort of maybe you hope some of those extra rest days will help Kirk when he's actually in the lineup.
Yeah, it's funny. He's finally back. But, you know, it's Bassett tonight. So run back out there, Alejandro Kirk.
Yeah.
We'll wait one more a day. Maybe the highlight of the weekend, because we love shiny new things, was Yariel Rodriguez, Caitlin, who got the start on Saturday, pitched very well. But, of course, there's an innings and pitch limit on Yariel Rodriguez this season. What's the best way to navigate that, do you think, for the rest of the year? I guess his body will tell the Blue Jays what they can do and how much they can use him. But looking at this rotation and looking what he was able to provide, how do you think they balance the restrictions and the value he may be able to deliver this team?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually going to be a really interesting situation to watch unfold because, you know, right now it looks like it's working out because you have him. He's pitching well. It's early in the season. So you can go with him a little bit. And I think the Blue Jays have said, and Schneider has said, it's like if he has a cap on his innings and he's pitching well, you want most of those innings to be happening when he can help the major league team. So I understand kind of why they called him up when they did. There was a need for him. And if he's going to help them win, they're going to use him. But the sort of interesting question for them is that you're in a situation where you have to sort of balance the short-term goal, which is winning this year, and winning this year is very, very important. But Yariel, you've signed him from a long-term contract. You're looking at this guy. Can this guy potentially be a starter for us for years to come? So you have to balance the long-term plan for him. And so, you know, I don't have the answer for that. I'm not paid enough to have the answer to that. I can just observe, but I think it is interesting because right now it's working, and maybe you do pair him with Bowden Francis, and you have Yariel going four innings and then Bowden comes out for two or three, and then you're kind of cobbling together what would be a traditional start, six or seven innings with two guys, and then you go to your bullpen. But then we look down a couple weeks and we hear, you know, Alek Manoah, he's pitching on Friday in Triple A. He's got, from when it started, which was a couple days ago, a 30-day window where he can have his rehab period in the minor leagues, but that's going to end at some point too. And then you're going to want to get slide him back. So then do you move Yariel to the bullpen? But what if he's pitching really well? Like, it's a very interesting puzzle. And it's one of these things where teams will say, well, it's a good problem to have, right? If you have too many good pitchers, that's what you want. But I do think that it's very interesting. Maybe, you know, the good thing with Yariel Rodriguez is that he does have experience in the bullpen. He has experience being a high leverage reliever in Japan. He can give you some length, so he could, maybe function as kind of a swing guy or someone that could come in, you know, after Manoah or whoever. But yeah, I don't exactly know what's going to unfold with him, but I do think it's something that's very interesting and worth watching with his team, because it will be a decision that is coming up, you know, sooner than we think.
Yeah, if there is legitimate hope for Manoah, maybe it's time to just pitch Rodriguez and dig into those innings limits, or carve into that innings limit, because, yeah, you need it now, and maybe Manoah will be there by the end of the season. We just did the highlight. Let's do the low light. I guess that was Kevin Gausman. And again, there's an excuse here. Missed spring training. He's doing spring training in the regular season. And as much as there was hope for that, maybe it wasn't all that advised. Is the concern-o-meter flickering at all for you when watching Gausman start so far this year?
You know, not quite. But I do think that it's one of those things where, like, in hindsight, could the team go, like, maybe we should have just started him on the IL, right? Like, I think the thinking was that we're better off with Gausman pitching for us, even if he's not fully built up, than we are without him. And I totally understood that logic. And you see him go out against Tampa in his first start, he looked really good. And you're like, okay, great plan. This is working out. He's a veteran guy. He knows how to take care of himself. But the thing with baseball is that, like, spring training and the way that it has been done for so long because it's the way that it works, right? And, like, you know, sometimes you can cut corners a little bit, but I think we're seeing right now that when you do cut corners, you sort of risk the process not playing out as it should be. So I think that with Gausman, I'm not concerned, because you look at the track record, you look at the history that he has, you know, done over his career, and you still feel really good about what he's doing. And I think with the Rockies series, or the Rockies game, I should say, it was interesting because he did get a lot of swing and miss, and so it wasn't like, oh, the stuff's not there at all. It was just he was getting hit a lot. So, you know, I think if that happened in spring, it would have been one of those things you just brush aside and say, he would say, I like the stuff. The stuff looked good. And everyone would say, yeah, the stuff did look good. It doesn't really matter if you win or lose in some training. So it is a tough situation. I think that for me, I give him like one more start. And then if it again goes bad, you sort of think like, then you start to think like, was this really a mistake, them going this way? I can understand how it's frustrating for Gausman because, you know, he's used to performing. It's a tough situation for him to be in, where you're still kind of feeling like spring training mode and you're in mid-April at this point. So it's a tough situation. Not too concerned yet, but, you know, TBD, depending on how his next start goes.
Last one for you, Caitlin. We appreciate your time ahead of the game. Yankees and Blue Jays. Now, the Yankees are coming in with the best record in MLB. Did you see that coming?
I probably didn't. But because I was really skeptical when Cole went out. I thought that was going to be a huge loss for them. I thought that was going to be tough to cover up. I think we saw last year their pitching was not quite what we thought it would be outside of Cole, obviously. And so I was really, really skeptical about how they would weather not being without their ace and, you know, being without one of the best pitchers in baseball. And you looked at their lineup and you're like, this is a really good lineup, but can it cover up? And you know what? They've been really great. Obviously, they've been a great offense. Their pitching has been really strong. Their bullpen has been strong, as you know it has been for years now for them. And their pitching has held its own, and it's been really good. And it's covered up for Cole's absence. And so, I would say that I am surprised, not because I didn't think that it was a good team. I just was really unsure about how they would start out with missing, you know, one of their core pieces.
Yeah, those Yankees, they find a way. I mean, Juan Soto probably helps too. So that one definitely we saw coming. Caitlin, we appreciate your time. Enjoy the game. Enjoy the next couple of days with the Yankees in town. And we'll talk soon.
Okay, thank you so much, guys.
Thank you. Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. So Chris Bassitt on the mound tonight. And Sportsnet.ca, there's a great new article by Shai Davidi. It was a little bit earlier today. And he was talking to Chris Bassitt about injuries. Pitching injuries. And I thought there's a really interesting quote that Chris Bassitt had to say when asked about all the new, the run of injuries, like Spencer Strider and Shane Bieber, et cetera. So, quote, "It makes me sick to watch the finger pointing on why all of this is happening, rather than everyone kind of taking the blame for themselves," Bassitt, who starts Monday in the series opener versus the New York Yankees, says during the interview. "First and foremost, it is the players to blame for throwing the way that we're trying to throw. But for people to think that it's not the pitch clock, that's completely wrong. It is the pitch clock. Training-wise, how people push training, it is that too. This is a much bigger issue because it's not a one-factor thing. It's not like we take one thing away and this goes away. This is a cumulative problem. Say we have 10 weights we're trying to hold. All of a sudden, you take one away and it's going to go away. That's not the way it is. The way that guys train, how hard they throw, and then you shorten that time frame of how you want people to do it, it's cumulative what's causing all that. So great article, and he's very honest and like insightful about this current issue in MLB. But, I mean, I think that is the perfect example of it being, yeah, you're going to have to throw harder now, and, yeah, the pitch clock is making your recovery time a little bit shorter. And the off season, as we talked, was it to – who did we talk to last week that was talking about the shorter recovery times that they do in the off season? Chris LaRue.
LaRue, yeah.
And all of that being – I feel like we're going to be seeing this more and more, and that's a terrible, like, thing to say. Obviously, I don't want to see injuries in baseball, but
– yeah.
The odds are stacked up against pitchers, it feels like.
Yeah, it's an occupational hazard, unfortunately. Yeah. But what he said about the weights, I think, makes perfect sense, right? Like, if you got five plates aside, you take off one, it's still going to be quite heavy, right? Mm-hmm. You're putting a lot of stress on your body. But if you take four plates aside off, well, you're not accomplishing anything because it's lightweight. That's not benefiting you in any really discernible way. So it feels like there's a balance they have to strike. And maybe the pitch clock, for that reason, was wrong to implement. But again, it's not just that, and you got to make some other adjustments. So yeah, it's all in the pitchers, and it's all in guys like Chris Bassitt, who get to speak openly and freely when, like, that's not your bag, throwing 95, 97, 99, like Chris Bassitt. He does it a different way. So it's, I guess, easier for him to say. But again, like, it's a competition, and everyone's going to be trying to be at their best, to be at their competitive best, or they're not going to be in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, we're going to see Chris Bassitt shortly on the mound. That's on Sportsnet 1 tonight and Sportsnet 590 The Fan after we take a break in the next couple minutes. But we were just talking about, quickly with Jeff Merrick, about the Women's World Championships. This was a really big weekend in sports. We asked you, the listeners, earlier on in the show, what was the best thing that you saw this weekend? Because I think we're in that sweet spot, right? We just had March Madness. We're just about to start the playoffs in both NHL and NBA. We just had the Masters, UFC 300. There's a lot to watch, so get your couches ready. So what was the best thing you saw this weekend?
The craziest thing I saw was Max Holloway in the BMF title bout. And I want to correct Aaron Bronsetter because he corrected me. It's not a real title. And that doesn't mean, though, that it's not as good or not worth our time. It's actually can set up the stage that we got, which was Holloway and Gaethje. When it's about being an alpha, not about excellence, you can have moments like the one that Max Holloway sucked Gaethje into, where he just, after dominating for 25 minutes or 24 minutes and 50 seconds, I suppose, good math,
that's great
that
math.
He could just give Gaethje an opportunity to actually beat him, to win the title that's not really a title, because it's about being an alpha and not being excellent. And because he was the alpha in that moment, he got $600,000 in bonus money. He gets the highlight of all highlights, and he raises his profile immensely. He's the BMF champ, but there's a reason why he's not the 145-pound champ, but that doesn't mean it's any worse.
That was an incredible scene. I'm rewatching it right now. 0.1 seconds left on the clock, and boom, bye-bye. That was definitely the top for many. I would say, obviously, briefly with Jeff, we're just talking about the Women's World Championships. Canada, United States, 6-5 overtime win for Canada after a back and forth game. You never see 5-5 games. You never see, you know, more than like a 2-2 game between these two teams, but it was Knight scoring, Poulin scoring, back and forth action, and eventually Canada gets the upset, really, because they were not the favorites in the United States, when last year I had to watch Canada lose the United States at home in Canada, so it kind of got that revenge back on them. But of course, that's my favorite rivalry in sports, and it's just getting better and better. And I do think a lot of credit should be given to the PWHL over the first couple weeks or months of the season, because the girls are in their best form. That was the most intense, athletic, well-balanced world championships that I've seen in a really long time. The other teams coming up, like Czech Republic and Finland, they took massive steps, and that's because they have girls playing in the PWHL. So that was the best thing I saw this weekend, and congrats to Canada and my girls for winning.
Yeah, it was incredible. And obviously, I mean, we should have been probably understanding this beforehand, but having a full season leading up to a championship would get the most out of the championship. It's funny how that works.
That is funny. Of course, Scottie Scheffler, I don't even know if it's like, it's just excellence now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as...
It's not alphaing. It's excellence.
It's just alpha. It's excellence.
Actually, it's both.
It's kind of both, but... Yeah, another one for him. It's kind of clinical at this point.
Yeah, he's getting into Tiger Woods territory. Quickly, best bet of the night, Islanders to beat the Devils in Jersey. Islanders need a win to sew up a playoff spot, so they'll get it tonight, minus 120.
My best bet is the New York Rangers, -1.5 on the puck line. They're going to win the Metro and the Eastern Conference and President's Trophy, or clinch it, if they can beat the Ottawa Senators tonight, and I think they do it all against a lowly team.
Love it.
Those are my best bets. Okay, well, on the other side of the break, you'll hear Sportsnet 590, The Fan, of course, the Yankees and the Toronto Blue Jays, and you can catch that up on Sportsnet 1 as well. Have a great night, everyone. Back tomorrow.